Today, my guest is Dr. Mary Manning. Mary is Portfolio Manager for the Asian and Indian Funds at Ellerston Capital. She has a PhD, Harvard MBA, and worked with the likes of George Soros and Howard Marks. In this interview, we discuss the economic growth stories of Asia, technological arms race, impact of coronavirus, and the upcoming US election. Enjoy the conversation. Since starting this podcast, many folks have reached out asking for advice about how to boost their financial IQ. Now I have a simple answer, and that's Rask Australia. Owen Raskovich is an investment analyst, investor, and educator. Since 2017, Owen has been creating courses and podcasts to help everyday Australians understand and take control of their money. He offers free courses on financial independence, shares, ETFs, and superannuation. The content is easy to follow, relevant, and applicable. If you want to level up and potentially manage your own investments, there's a special discount to my listeners on all of his premium courses. To sign up for one of Owen's free courses and save up to $200 on his paid programs, visit medicalmoney.com/rask. That's R-A-S-K, and boost your financial IQ today. Hi, I'm Andrew, and this is the Medical Money Podcast, where we help doctors earn, grow, and protect their money. If you enjoy the show, please remember to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review. Please send your questions, comments, and feedback to me at andrew@medicalmoney.com. This podcast contains general advice about financial products and is not personal financial advice. Any opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not take into account listeners' individual objectives, financial situation, or needs. Please seek professional advice before making any financial or investment decision and always read the product disclosure statement. Mary, thanks for joining us today. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be on and speak with you today.
Yeah, and whereabouts are you working from or calling in today?
So I'm working from home. I live in Sydney, and I've been working from home since late February, early March. And I've gone to the office twice, once for a board meeting and once to pick up a bigger screen because my eyesight was failing working at home. But other than that, me and the team we're all working from home, and we're settled in and we're quite enjoying it.
Oh, very good. An overwhelming proportion of my listeners are of Asian and Indian heritage, so I think they'll be very interested to listen to your thoughts on today's topic. I'm really excited to get your insights into the growth stories of Asia and India and your perspectives on technology, coronavirus, and also geopolitics at the moment. But before we dig into these topics, could you please share with us your journey in the world of business, academia, and also investing?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm originally from Canada. And I went and I did an undergrad in finance. And then the big U.S. investment banks, they hired one person from my university every year. And it was mostly Solomon Brothers, which, you know, it takes you back a number of years as a big investment bank in New York that had an interesting reputation. They came to my university and hired one person. And I made it my goal that I was going to be that person. And somehow I managed to accomplish that goal. And I moved to New York at the ripe old age of 21. And sort of got thrown into the deep end. So that was a great place to start because I knew absolutely nothing. So the learning curve was very steep. Then after that, I did a few years investing in emerging markets. And that was sort of where my love of Asia and emerging markets and these growth stories and different kinds of companies came from. I also love traveling to these countries. So that sort of got me exposure to some very interesting things early on in my career. Then I went to Harvard and I did an MBA at Harvard, which is an amazing experience. I'm sure a lot of the people that listen to your podcast are very well educated and spent a lot of time in school themselves. And just that sort of intellectual environment, I absolutely loved it. So then after Harvard, I worked for George Soros in New York. And that again, I mean, Soros is an iconic sort of investor. As many of you know, he's famous for breaking the Bank of England and shorting the pound and sort of making his name on that. So to be working for someone that iconic and with that level of intellectual breadth and depth at a very young age and a very early time in my career was amazing. Then after Soros, I went and worked specifically for an emerging markets fund. Soros was doing global equities. I worked for Oaktree Capital doing emerging markets. That was also a very interesting experience and got a lot of on-the-ground experience there. I worked both in the New York office and in Singapore. In between there, I actually left the investing world altogether, and I got a PhD in economics. So this is something I think we can talk about later in the podcast. It actually had to do with health and economic development and the impact of pandemics. I looked specifically at HIV/AIDS on economic development. So that was something totally different. But interestingly, with the onset of COVID, a lot of the lessons that I learned doing my PhD, which I thought would never be applicable to my investing life, have actually become quite applicable. And then, you know, somewhere along there, I had the good sense to marry an Aussie. And so he wanted to move home. And we had been living in Singapore for about 5 years. And our kids were about to start school. And we decided we wanted to be somewhere where we were going to stay. So we moved to Australia and I joined Ellerston Capital. And I've been there for the last 9 years running the Asia funds. So that's a brief synopsis of my career.
Fantastic. What was it like working and meeting Soros and Howard Marks, who are kind of like living investment legends at the moment?
Well, so George, by the time I got to Soros, he was older and he wasn't really involved in the day-to-day stuff, but he was still very, very involved in, as some of you know, Soros also has a big sort of philanthropic arm, the Open Society Institute, and a lot of the things he was doing on that side. So being able to engage on that kind of stuff and just see what he was doing with the money that he made was a very interesting part of working at Soros. And it also, he made his money by a short, like his most famous trade was a short. And so early on in your career, having someone, that clearly thinks differently and that understands that there's downside to stocks and currencies and a lot of the things that we invest in, that's a good lesson to learn early on in your career because, you know, things don't always go up. And the sooner you figure that out, the better you are, the better off you are.
And so you're running long only funds at the moment though, aren't you?
Yeah. So all the funds that I run now are long only. And just to answer your other question about Howard Marks, Howard also, I wasn't clearly interacting with him on a day-to-day basis, but the times when I did meet him, and one stands out in particular in the Singapore office. So there was only about seven of us in the Singapore office. So when he came to visit, it was a big deal. And we, went out for lunch one time and I was sitting next to him and he said, "Oh, I hear that you used to work for us in the New York office and then you left to do your PhD and you came back." And I said, "Yep, I did." And he said, "Well, that's fantastic. We love when people actually come back to the firm. It says a lot about us and it says a lot about you. So that's good." And then he said, "What did you do your PhD on?" And I said, "Oh, it actually has nothing to do with investing." And, a lot of people would have just left it with that and moved on to something that they have an expertise in. But he was like, "Well, tell me what it is," and asking questions. And, "Well, so what did you find?" And what just that sort of inquiring mind. And having the sort of intellect that just wants to know the answers. And that's something that really stood out for me working at Oaktree and with Howard Marks. And it's not surprising someone who has that level of intellect can build up the kind of firm that he did with Oaktree.
And such an inquisitive kind of nature that he does put across in his articles that he puts out. They are long, but very, very insightful as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And so let's move across to your perspective as a portfolio manager with obviously, you've got dozens, if not decades, in the emerging market space. You're running three investment funds at the moment that are focused on growth companies in the Asian markets. What excites you about investing in this space? And what do you think some of the things that Australian investors investing only in Australia might be overlooking by not thinking about these markets?
Yeah, so this is a great question. I could talk about this all day. So I know I don't have all day, but really, I'm really passionate about this aspect of the funds that I run. All the funds that I run are growth funds. And I think that globally, growth is becoming more and more and more scarce, particularly structural growth. So if you look at the growth that's in developed markets like the US or Japan or Europe or Australia, it's very low, typically around 2%. And a lot of that is driven by policy. So particularly in the US and Europe and Japan, they have had zero interest rate policy or very low interest rate policy since the GFC in some examples, and then in Japan for many decades. And part of the way that they get this growth is by ultra loose monetary policy and then, sort of spurts of fiscal policy. Australia now is also falling into that trap with very, very low interest rates, not very much more room to move there. And, fiscal being a bit messed up now with COVID and not a lot more room to go on in terms of fiscal policy. But Asia is completely opposite. Asia is a structural growth story that is achieving very high growth rates. I mean, prior to COVID, Asia was growing at around three times faster than developed markets. And, that sort of growth is driven by different things. It's driven by demographics and the rise of the middle class and infrastructure build and technology leapfrogging, and it's driven by the maturation of capital markets and money flowing in from individual investors. And there's a lot of really exciting things going on that have nothing to do with the policy environment of the country at that time. So I think that getting access to those sort of growth stories is really exciting. And I think that growth deserves a spot in everybody's portfolio. And from some of the feedback I've heard over recent years is that people tend to go to US tech stocks to get growth. And you can see by the way that they've performed that that's sort of a global phenomenon. But those aren't the only places in the world that you can get growth. And so I challenge your listeners to look at Asia and look at emerging markets as an important source of growth in your portfolio.
And a lot have families in those emerging markets, so they kind of have some on-the-ground conversations that are easy to expose themselves to as well. And so let's talk a bit about Asia ex-India to begin with. You actively seek opportunities in about a dozen countries, I understand, in the region. What do you see as the big growth drivers for specific countries and industries in this area? You touched on it a little bit more previously that it's structural changes, but are there industries that are specific to this area?
Yeah, so my fund is very focused on new economy companies. So typically around 80% of our portfolio is in only three sectors: technology, financials, and consumer. And that is very consistent since inception around 5 years ago. Those are the three sectors that we target. And so, you know, part of the reason is because those are the high growth ones. There's a lot of industrials are not achieving certain levels of growth. A lot of material companies, they're very cyclical. So they might get growth if the oil price is going up or if the iron ore price is going up. But then once going the other way, they're actually posting negative growth. So those sorts of stocks generally don't make it into our portfolio either. So I see in Asia, technology is obviously a very, very important place to be. At certain points in this year and at the end of August, we had about 56% of our portfolio in tech or tech-related stocks. So that is very big bet on technology. And it's also very different and, you know, a source of diversification for Australian investors. Because even if you own all of the major tech stocks in Australia, if you own all of the waxes, you are never going to get to 56% of your portfolio. But in Asia, if you look at the biggest companies in Asia, they're all tech companies. Alibaba, Tencent, Samsung, TSMC, Meituan, PDD, JD, they're all tech companies. So I think that technology is a really exciting space in Asia. Consumer, when I mentioned before about the rising middle class as one of the drivers of structural growth, consumer is one of the best ways to play that. So we like a lot of consumer companies, particularly in China and India. And then lastly, financials. You know, just to compare it to Australia, in a lot of countries, you know, financial penetration of things like mortgages and credit cards and insurance is a tiny fraction of what it is in the developed world. So one of the reasons why I like financials in emerging markets and in Asia much more than I do in developed markets is because they still have a very, very long runway of growth. So I know you asked about Asia ex India, but if you look at India, for example, you know, they could sustain 20% loan growth for the next 10 years and they would still be at a fraction of credit penetration, you know, that Australia is. So that's one of the reasons why I like financials. Right now, our strong preference of those three sectors is for technology, and consumer is second and financials is last.
And how about in the Southern Asian parts in ASEAN? Countries like Indonesia has got a massive population, and then we've got Malaysia, Vietnam as well with large resources. Do you look at those much, or do you just stick outside of those kind of you know, smaller countries with a bit more of an industrial and human resource side?
No, so we do look at those countries, and they are part of my benchmark, which is MSCI Asia ex Japan. So that's all the countries that are in Asia, excluding Japan. And we can also look at some of the frontier markets that you mentioned, like Vietnam. To be completely frank, though, right now, I find those economies very challenging to find good investment opportunities. So one thing that your listeners should know about my funds is that all of them are benchmark independent. So even though I invest in Asia, if I am not finding any opportunities in Indonesia, I can have zero investments there. If I'm finding nothing in Malaysia, I can have zero investments there. And that's quite different than a lot of my peers who, you know, their mandates instruct that they have to have certain allocation to all the countries in Asia. So right now, because I have that sort of benchmark independent approach, I have no investments in Indonesia, none in Malaysia, none in Thailand, none in Philippines, and only on one Singapore bank. So really in that whole, and nothing in Vietnam or Cambodia. So in that whole ASEAN region, we have very, very low exposure. So it's not that those are, you know, they're bad countries or they're not exciting or the growth things that I mentioned before aren't happening there. But COVID in particular has hit those countries quite hard. As you may know, Jakarta is back down in lockdown. Philippines, we're not even sure what the numbers are coming out of Philippines. And those countries also are significantly lacking in terms of technological innovation. And so while in China and India and Korea and Taiwan, there are these big large cap tech companies that you can invest in, there are basically no or very, very limited number of technology companies in ASEAN. So as a fund that loves technology, that is a disappointment for us. And then lastly, I'd say that because there's no big technology companies, then a lot of the consumer and financial companies, they become very expensive on a price to earnings basis or on a price to book basis because people don't have anything else to invest in. So then when we compare the consumer companies in those markets to consumer companies elsewhere in Asia, they look very expensive. So a combination of all those things mean that we have very little exposure to ASEAN right now.
Okay. And so China is the up-and-coming world power and the second largest economy. It always kind of, I'm always find it weird that it's called an emerging market when it's already so massive and, you know, not far off being the number one. Can you, and you've also talked about the hegemonic decline of the US. How do you see this playing out and what areas do you think China might claim global leadership or dominance in the not too distant future?
So interesting you ask, because we have morning meetings since we're all working at home, every morning meeting. And this was our topic this morning because on my team, we really like scenario analysis. Yeah, I find it quite a helpful framework so that you are always sort of pushing the boundaries of your own assumptions and your own biases. So, you know, like a previous example was during the trade war, we had, okay, this is our base case that it's sort of low level skirmishes. The worst case is that, you know, Trump goes all out and really tries to hammer China. And, you know, then China has extreme retaliation. And the best case is that this all sort of goes away the longer Trump goes into his administration. So we're always looking at scenario analysis. And the scenario analysis we were talking about this morning was exactly this, is the conflict between the US and China. And what is our base case in that conflict? And what are sort of the long tail risk outcomes for both countries? So my base case is exactly what you said, that America is in hegemonic decline, and it has been for decades now, and China is the ascendant superpower. And that is our base case. That's like 80% of what we think is going on, is going to continue to go on for the next 5-10 years. This is not a like short-term phenomenon. Well, what does that mean for investors and for asset allocators? I think, you know, a lot of people, particularly in Australia, will have significant exposure to the US versus what they have to the rest of the world. And, you know, Ray Dalio, who's another amazing investor, has said it better than I could, that if you have these two horses that are running in this race for sort of global economic and political dominance, why would you not bet a little bit on the second horse? And when I meet with investors across Australia, many of them don't have investments in China. They are not betting on the second horse. So that's our sort of base case, is that China is on the up and you need to have some investments in China, because to not do so and to have all your offshore investments, or, you know, predominantly your offshore investments based on the country that's in decline is very risky. So then, you know, in terms of the long-term tail risks, I am much more worried about the long-term the long tail risks in the US than I am in China. So I'm quite concerned about this upcoming election. I think there's a lot of scope for there's a lot of scope for mistake. There's a lot of scope for infighting. There's a lot of scope for things to go wrong. But, you know, prior to this very recent correction, U.S. markets were at all-time highs. And if you look at a lot of things that are going on in the U.S., I mean, it is looking a lot like an emerging market. I mean, there's civil unrest in the streets. You have highly politicized Supreme Court decisions. You have, you know, presidents putting out executive orders, seizing assets and banning other ones. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of emerging market-esque behavior going on in America, but it's still priced like a superpower. Whereas China is the opposite. It is a rising superpower, and yet it's still priced like an emerging market. So to me, that's a really big opportunity, and that's why I have more than 50% of my portfolio in China.
Mm-hmm. And you also run Ellison's India Fund. India's population is about to crack 1.4 billion, I think, very soon. What is India's growth story, and how will it be similar or different from what we have witnessed in China over the past few decades?
Okay, so I'll start by giving you the pre-COVID growth story. And then there is a bit of a an alteration because of COVID. So, you know, India, as you say, is a very populous country, and the GDP per capita is very low. So just mathematically, the ability for that GDP per capita to catch up to even other developing countries, let alone developed countries, means that there is a lot of growth there and that there's a lot of opportunity. So India, I've been covering India for almost 20 years now. The first time I went to India was 2002. And I invested in a lot of the Indian banks then. And, you know, India sort of bubbled along. There were some periods when it was doing well, some periods when it was not doing well. And then for me, a lot of things changed when Prime Minister Modi came in, because he is a reformer. He has, you know, very strong popular support. He has execution abilities. And you may know, or some of your listeners may know, that in his first term, he did a lot of stuff, a lot of policies that, you know, had been talked about in India for years, whether it's, you know, GST or, you know, the Real Estate Act or demonetization, which was a surprise, but which was a very big change in India. These were things where he just pushed it through. So, you know, I was very excited about India. And that's one of the reasons why we started the India Fund, was to give people direct exposure to India. Because in MSCI emerging markets, India is a very small weight. And even within MSCI Asia, India is only about a 9% weight. So if you want direct exposure to India and you buy an Asia fund, you're getting swamped by China and Korea and Taiwan. So that's the reason we started India and the India Fund. And that long-term growth story, like as in 5-10 years, is definitely still intact. And so longer term, still very, very positive on the opportunities in India. In the short term, though, COVID has been horrendously mismanaged. As I'm sure you know, given your background and the background of your listeners, India was one of the first countries to actually go down into very hard, like stage four level lockdowns. And it was the only country that did so and that has been completely unsuccessful at flattening the curve. So current new COVID cases in India right now are running around almost at 100,000 new cases. They're actually bubbling along around 98,000. And we're thinking that they're fudging these numbers because they just don't want to post a six-figure COVID case per day. So that's really bad. Even on a you know, per capita basis, that's very bad. And it has really brought to light the underdevelopment of the health system in India. And it's really brought to light the some of the issues in the social system. Like a lot of the reasons why it expanded so much was because of migrant workers going home and then coming back again. So India, I think from an economic perspective, is going to struggle for the next year. That said, the Indian market has done very well. I mean, I was just looking at my performance prior to this call, and in the last 2 months, the Indian market is up over 10%. It's back to where it was pre-COVID. So to me, there seems like there's a little bit of a disconnect between what's going on fundamentally in the economy and what's going on in the market. But we're just going to wait until those two things even themselves out. Either the market has to catch down to where the economy is, or the economy has to catch up to where the market is. Once that happens, I feel very confident in the long-term growth story in India.
From a kind of family unit, we had the one-child policy over in China. What's the family unit and the population growth and ages like in India?
Yeah, so this is the demographics, and the specifics of the demographics is a very big important point for investing in India. So, you know, one child policy messed everything up in terms of dependency ratios. And now you have an aging population in China, which are dependent on a very few number of youths. And so that, it's a problem. It's also an opportunity. It's one of the reasons we own a lot of insurance companies in China, because as people, you know, go along the life cycle, the sort of products that they need change. And, you know, life insurance is something that people start worrying about later on in life. And that's why we own companies like China Life and Ping An. But India is the opposite. The population pyramid is very, very bottom heavy, where you have, you know, 60% of the population is under the age of 30. And that is really important for the consumer stock that we invest in, which I mentioned before, because when you have that much of the population and that number of people, just in absolute terms, I think there's like 400 million Indian millennials. You know, if even a portion of them get to the income level where they can, you know, buy their first scooter, we own companies like, you know, Hero Motor, they can buy their first scooter and then they can buy their first car. We own Maruti Suzuki. And instead of, you know, buying things in informal markets, they want to buy Hindustan Unilever products and Nestle products. There's just a whole scope of, you know, sort of riding that wave of the rising middle class in India, which can happen. And the fact that the demographics are very bottom heavy, it helps support that in the longer term.
They also have the English language is much stronger prevalence than China did as well, don't they?
Yeah, so it is. India is a very easy country to do business in. I love going there, and that's one of a sad thing is that some of our investors asked us when are you going to travel to India again? And I think I've no idea. It could be quite a while until we go back there. But yes, it's very easy to do business there. I do have a team, though, that has language skills in all the almost all the countries that we invest in. So I have two Mandarin speakers, one who focuses exclusively on Korea, on China and Hong Kong, and another individual who's originally, his family is from Taiwan, so he focuses on Taiwan and Korea. And then we do have a specific Indian analyst named Vinay Chota, who focuses just on India. So regardless, even in countries where there is, different language, I have that covered via my team.
And so there's the internal growth story. We've seen a lot of IT services and outsourcing to Indian companies from the US. Are there any other industries that you think India will dominate on an outbound side of things?
Yeah, pharma is one, and one which your listeners may be interested in. So the pharma industry in India, I'd invest in it for 5 years plus because it was very, very difficult to make money in. Obviously India is a huge manufacturer of pharmaceuticals, both generic and other kinds of pharmaceuticals. But in the last 5 years, there's kind of been a under the cover trade war going on between the US and India. And it's not a trade war like the one with China where, Trump and Xi are on the front page of the paper exchanging barbs every morning. It's more the US FDA went into a lot of these Indian pharma companies and really, really, really cracked down. To the extent that a lot of their capacity was taken offline and they became almost uninvestable because you'd think you'd own a good pharma company, the US FDA would go into their plant on some sort of witch hunt and they would get shut down and the stocks down 20%. Now, interestingly, now that the world is facing a pandemic, the US has realized that actually that's probably not a great strategy and making sure that, Indian pharma has the capacity to produce generics, has the capacity to produce vaccines. The Serum Institute is actually going to be the biggest producer of the AstraZeneca vaccine. And so India is now seen as playing an important role in global healthcare rather than the US trying to go after them to, gain market share for their own companies. So we do like some of the Indian healthcare companies right now. In the India Fund, we own quite a few, everything from, Dr. Reddy's to Sun Pharma are probably our two biggest positions. We also own Cadilla and then Dr. Lal Path Labs, which is more of a testing play. But I think that pharma is somewhere where India has a unique capability. In terms of manufacturing, no, India is never going to be the next China. A lot of that capacity that wanted to go to lower income countries, it's gone to Vietnam and Cambodia, and India sort of missed that boat. So I think that pharma and IT services are going to continue to be the main sectors where India exports. That said, the reason to invest in India is not because of its exports. It's because of the domestic demand story in the consumer and financials.
Okay. So many Australian companies benefit from China's growth. We've seen steel, milk powder and wine. How do you see Australian companies getting involved in India's growth?
So it's hard. Recently I was asked by the Asia Link Business, which is an organization that's part of the University of Melbourne, to write a chapter for one of their books or one of their big reports called Winning in Asia. And it was on exactly that topic. So, obviously the relationship between China and Australia is deteriorating. And in my opinion, it's going to continue to deteriorate over time. And so a lot of people in Australia, the business community and the political community are sort of looking for a replacement for China. And, what I always say to people is India is not the next China. India is the first India, and if it's certainly not a substitute for China. So there's a number of reasons for that. One is, of particular importance to people in Perth is that India is self-sufficient in iron ore. So even if India builds out and has that sort of, big real estate and development boom like China did, it's not going to create the same demand for iron ore that China did. I think the second thing for a lot of the consumer companies that you mentioned before, whether it's like wine or milk or beef, is that a lot of those products are not popular in India for cultural reasons. And the second thing is, even if they were popular in India, there's no sort of Daigo channel in India. So the distribution is very, very hard. Also, the price points of a lot of those products are too high for the large part of the Indian population. So it puts Australian companies in a bit of a tricky situation because, you can't just replicate the let's ship iron ore and milk and beef and wine to India and they can be a replacement for China. So I think companies are going to have to be very creative about what they do. The other thing that I found in researching this chapter for the report was that hardly anybody is successful in India without investing on the ground. it is not a sit in your home country and send stuff over there sort of market. It's you have to be in on the ground and you have to have people on the ground and you have to be investing there. Some of the most successful companies and case studies that I looked at, they've been in India since the 1800s. And so, you know, they've got a couple hundred year head start on Australian companies. But I think that India is a very exciting market and Australian companies should consider it because they're going to need to go offshore to get growth, but it's certainly not the next China.
That's very interesting because obviously there's a lot of stuff in China in the press, but not so much on India. Just on that, on the press topic, how do you find that people's kind of thought process about these emerging markets in Australia from Australian media sources is kind of lensed or modified?
So I often say to my investors, if you want to understand what's going on in Asia, the first thing you should do is stop reading the Australian press. It is very, very biased and it is very biased against China. So, I mean, if people want to read it, that's fine, but just be aware that there is a lens that is over the media. So I read more global news sources. I don't read any Australian news sources. They're reporting on Asia. I use primarily global news sources. And frankly speaking, I'm an investor. I'm passionate and really trying to get the right answer and get the right stocks and stocks that are going up and making sure that I'm generating the right returns for my investors. So I'm not particularly concerned with people's opinions. Like I want to know facts. So for that, I usually use Bloomberg. Like I get 90% of my news off Bloomberg because it's factual and you're looking at numbers. You're not looking at, you know, highly politicized views. So if people are interested in figuring out what's going on in Asia, I would encourage you to find sources offshore and then, you know, sort of compare them to what you're seeing at home. But yeah, I am constantly shocked at the level of bias against Asia and particularly against what's going on at a lot of Asian companies. So I'll give you an example. If you read Australian press, it's always, you know, Asian companies are corrupt and these bad things are going on, et cetera, et cetera. And I traveled to Asia on a business trip during the Royal Commission. And almost across the board, people were saying to me, like, what's going on in Australia? I met with a lot of banks, so they were watching it. And they're saying, like, what's going on in Australia, that Royal Commission? That's terrible. They, it's a very bad ESG event. And so I think that there's a bit of a double standard is that when things happen in Asia, the press reports them as you know, oh, there's something wrong with these countries. But when very similar, even worse things happen in Australia, there's not that, it's a double standard in terms of how people report it.
That's interesting. And that segues nicely to my next question on it seems like you're in your investment process, you have a very strong focus on growth hurdles that need to be met for the companies, but then you also have a very strong emphasis on the environmental sustainability and governance elements. Can you give us a brief overview of your investment selection criteria and what will exclude companies? Because I've noticed that I've heard you mention that you've sold companies when there is a significant ESG event just to make sure that it fits with that criteria that you have.
Yeah. Okay. So there's two parts to that question. I'll deal with the how companies get into the portfolio first and then the ESG, which is part of that process. So as I mentioned at the beginning, we are a growth fund. Every single stock that gets into the portfolio has to meet growth criteria. And that initial criteria is 10% EPS growth, consistent over 3 years. And so like in an Australian context, that's very hard to find a whole portfolio of companies that could jump over that growth hurdle. In Asia, it's relatively easy. There are more than 600 companies in our universe that jump over that hurdle. So we have this process and you can think of it as like a runner that's in a race. The stock is the runner and they have to jump over all these hurdles. And if they make it over all the hurdles, then they are part of a focus list, which are the companies that we draw from to go into the portfolio. So the first one is growth. That's, about 600 companies make it over that hurdle. The second is valuation. So we do a very basic upside analysis and they have to have at least 50% upside on that methodology to, continue on in the process. So they keep running in the race. There's two other hurdles, which are industry structure and thematics. And then there's two knockout hurdles. So what this means is even if you score very well on the other criteria, if you trip over one of these hurdles, you're totally out of the race. So one is management. We have to have met with or, these days it's more talk on the phone or have a Zoom with someone from each company that we invest in. You can't invest in a company unless you have a relationship with someone internally. And then we have a whole set of criteria for how we rate management. And if management is, bad management, we don't invest in that company. And then the last one is ESG. And ESG is something that I am very I feel very strongly about. And for a number of reasons, like, first of all, because I think it's the right thing to do. But secondly, all the funds that I run are concentrated portfolios. So I can have a maximum of 50 stocks and are typically in the Asia funds, we typically have around 30. And in the India fund, we typically have around 20, 22. And so if you are running a fund in a region where there's over 10,000 listed stocks and you only have 20 to 30, you need to be really, really sure that those are good companies. Because if you have a blow up in one of those, you know, it can ruin your performance. It'll take you years to dig yourself out of that hole. So part of the reason we developed our ESG process was to make sure that we are always screening out those very high risk companies that could blow up the portfolio. So we do a number of things. We screen out certain sectors, like significant harm sectors. That includes weapons and tobacco. We screen out, they're not considered significant harm, but things like gaming, you know, coal, pornography. We screen out those sectors right from the get-go. That gets rid of around 8% of the companies in Asia. Then we have another screening and scoring process, which is proprietary. These are screens and scores that we came up with that, you know, screen out companies that score very badly on a number of ESG criteria. And they score so badly and so consistently badly that we're not even going to waste time looking at them. And then, you know, that leaves us with about 80% of the benchmark. And then for those, we do an ESG process as part of our investment process, and we give companies a score of -1, 0, or +1, and that goes into their overall score. The last thing that we do, which is really important, is that we actually measure our ESG risk versus our benchmark. So there are companies, Sustainalytics is the one that we do, that they, you know, they have risk ratings and very, very detailed risk ratings for most of the large companies in Asia. So what we do is we run our portfolio versus their portfolio, and we always want to come out with a result where we have less exposure to severe ESG risks than our benchmark. We have and we have higher exposure to management that does a good job of managing ESG risks. We also do that same thing for carbon, and we want to make sure that our carbon metrics are always better than the benchmark. So if you put all that together, we think that we come up with a portfolio that's very high growth and also very high quality.
That's very interesting. And so many Australian investors have shunned away from investing in countries like China because they don't trust the state-owned enterprises, transparency of government, and risk of confiscation. How do you approach these political and government risks in structuring a portfolio?
So part of it gets taken care for us because we have these growth criteria. So right now in the portfolio, we don't have, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, in the 32 stocks that we have right now, only one of them is government owned. And that's one in China. Primarily, we do not invest in SOEs, A, because of some of the reasons you mentioned, but B, because usually SOE companies are not well managed. So they get kicked out on the management front. And they also generally are not doing very well, so they don't even meet our growth criteria. So in general, we do not have SOEs at all. The second thing I would say is I did start, the first time I ever went to Asia and in an investment context was in 1997 during the Asian crisis. And, you know, that 23 years ago, things were quite bad, and that was a risk. But Asia has improved significantly since then. I have never, in 20 plus years of investing in Asia, had a situation where assets have been tried to, you know, whether there's been like a risk of the government taking assets, not once. And so I think that in the current times, that risk is quite overblown. It's never happened to me in 23 years. And then the last thing I'll mention on your question is that look at what happened in the U.S. recently. So there is an asset that's owned by a company that Donald Trump doesn't like, and he banned it and then sold it to one of his friends and supporters. So I'm talking about TikTok. And, you know, so if that kind of stuff is happening in America, it's what I mentioned before about being a double standard. People invest in America all the time, and no one says, I'm not investing in America because my assets might get, you know, stripped away and sold to someone who supports the president. So if there has to be a consistent standard. And that's never happened to me in Asia. And I think that things have gotten significantly better in the last few years so that it won't happen to the stocks that I own.
And you spent some time in Russia as an analyst. Where do you see Russia's role kind of in the global economy at the moment?
So I went to Russia. I was very young. I was 22 years old. And I really had no clue what was going on. But I wanted exposure to emerging markets because I think they're so exciting. And one thing that bugs me is people who spent their entire lives living in New York or Connecticut or Sydney, and they've never spent time on the ground in emerging markets, and then they claim expertise. That doesn't sit well with me. So even in my very early 20s, I thought, well, if I'm going to have a career in emerging markets, I need to spend time on the ground. So I moved to Russia, but my timing was terrible, and it was only about 6 months before the Russian crisis in the late 90s. And so things didn't work out very well from a work perspective. There was no work to do because everyone was just sort of sitting there watching the economy crash. But it was a very good experience for me at that time in my career, because I'd already gotten into business school, so I wasn't particularly worried about my job. Just to see what can go wrong in emerging markets. And, you know, they are risky and they can unravel quite quickly. So being able to sort of live through that was a good lesson for me early on in my career. Right now, I am not positive on Russia at all. I think the structure of the economy with the oligarchs and Putin's control is very unfavorable. And if you look at the kind of companies, so we don't invest in Russia, just so your listeners know, it's not considered part of our benchmark. But I have invested in the past running emerging market mandates. And, you know, it's basically still a petro state. Almost all the big large cap companies are oil and gas or somehow related to energy. None of them would meet our ESG criteria. So if I were to be investing in Russia, I'm not sure what I would buy. I can't think of anything off the top of my head that would move both my growth and my ESG criteria in Russia. So I think it's not a market I'm excited about.
I'm partway through reading Red Notice, and that's quite interesting in getting the Bill Browder's perspectives from back in around that time, I suppose, when you were also over in Russia as well, and just the things that they were put through from the Russian government as business, as investors over there. The technological arms race. In recent years, we've seen technology companies really leading the indexes, at least in the US, and your investment portfolios have large tech weightings. Can you explain what you call the technological arms race and how it's playing out right now?
Sure. So the tech arms race, about 2 years ago, me and my team, I think I mentioned before that we had this scenario analysis, and it was about U.S. hegemonic decline and the rise of China. And at the time, Trump was going very hard on the trade war. And, you know, it started with steel and then it got into soybeans and stuff. And we were thinking, you know what, at the end of the day, this is not going to be about steel and soybeans. Those are commodities that were important, you know, in the 1980s or, you know, in agricultural times. And it's not that they're not important now, but they're not going to be the flashpoint as these two superpowers clash. It's going to be about technology. And so we did this big report. It was like 56 slides long, and we showed it to some of our investors, and they're like, this is very interesting. Okay. You know, on to the next thing. And then recently, because of the issues that have come out with Huawei and more recently with TikTok and WeChat, you know, people have called us back and said, can you send us that report? Because like, you guys are really onto something there. And so the technological arms race, it's like the Cold War, but instead of having nuclear weapons, it's, you know, technology of one superpower going against technology of the other. And that is why, you know, in our opinion, it's because Trump and people in the Trump administration are very worried about China's technological prowess, that they are going hard on companies like Huawei, and why they are doing things like banning WeChat and TikTok. So we did an analysis of which parts of tech is, if you, you know, agree with the premise that this is a technology cold war, who's winning in different subsectors. And the outcome was actually quite interesting. I mean, according to our analysis, and people can debate it if they want, but, you know, China's already ahead in things like e-commerce and electric vehicles and a lot of those aspects of tech. The U.S. remains ahead, certainly in military technology, and also remains ahead with respect to operating systems and software. So, you know, every phone runs on almost every phone runs on Android or iOS, and China doesn't have its own operating system. But other than that, you know, it's much more equally balanced than people might think. People might think because of the fangs that China is way ahead. So the other thing that's happened very recently is people started talking about the splinternet and whether, you know, you do get the internet and a lot of these sort of social media companies where they just split. There's like Western companies and then there's Chinese companies and companies and countries that are aligned with China. So that is a real possibility. So I'll go back to one of my earlier comments about bet on the second horse. If that actually happens, you don't just want to have U.S. tech in your portfolio. You need to have U.S. tech and Chinese tech. And that's part of the reason we have very big positions in like Tencent and Alibaba.
And so that's in like an advancement of technology race. How about in terms of cybersecurity and stealing intellectual property? How do you see that kind of playing out? Is there going to be a kind of theft issue in that cybersecurity space?
So getting back to your early question about the press, I personally think that all this, like, you know, IP theft and cybersecurity and stuff is an issue that has been misreported. So, for example, and it's been misreported, and that has been used by the Trump administration as a way to sort of damage China. So, for example, on IP theft, so I'm not talking about like in the 1980s, if you went to China and you could buy, you know, like DVDs on the street. Of course, that happens, and everybody knows that's happened, and it's been, you know, largely cleaned up by now. What we're talking is about sort of like corporate technological espionage, which is what in the early days of the trade war, some of the people in the Trump administration, like Navarro and Lighthizer, they were claiming that China did that, and that was the rationale for why they were hitting back with a lot of these sanctions and trade measures. And so we did a big analysis of this, and we asked a lot of our companies in Korea and Taiwan, you know, how come you guys aren't complaining about cybersecurity and corporate espionage in tech? Because Korea and Taiwan are the two of the biggest, you know, technological countries in the world. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, it's not theft. A lot of American companies have been very, very sloppy with their IP. And they went to China because it was cheaper to produce technological goods there. So if you go there and you set up factories and you don't protect your IP, that's not theft. That's being sloppy. And interestingly, if you recall, it was right in the middle of COVID, so maybe 2-3 months ago, when a lot of the CEOs of the big U.S. tech companies, you know, it was all on Zoom, but they had to testify before Congress. Not one of them could pinpoint an example of Chinese technological theft. Not one of them. And so I think that whole thing was used by people in the Trump administration, you know, as a way to crack down on China when there's not significant evidence that it happens at the large corporate level. Cybersecurity, though, in conjunction with military technology, yes, that's a rising flashpoint. But there's not really any stocks in Asia that we can invest in that would be a play on that. So it's something that we watch less closely than, say, supply chain or internet or social media, which have a lot of large companies in those subsectors.
Hmm. And on coronavirus, how has coronavirus played out in Asia and India, and what economic outcomes do you see unfolding over the next months to years?
So COVID in Asia is a bit bifurcated. So you have the North Asian countries where COVID hit first, and which, in my opinion, did a very good job of managing the epidemic and of flattening the curve. So, you know, for Korea and Taiwan, not unlike Australia, they're island countries and they're small. And Taiwan in particular, you know, has a lot of, it's kind of like the anti-US. There's a lot of pro-science and pro-science people in the administration. And so I think that was very, very helpful. Taiwan has done, as I'm sure many of your listeners already know, a great job of controlling COVID. China, just the fact that they managed to control it in such a large population, I think is pretty impressive. So the macro data that we look at in North Asia is pretty much back to normal. So right now we have a disproportionate amount of our portfolio invested in North Asia because they are sort of out of the other side of COVID. And even in countries like Korea, where you've had second waves, they've been quite successful at clamping down on those second waves. So we like North Asia, certainly over ASEAN and India. As I mentioned before, India has been quite spectacularly unsuccessful, actually, at managing COVID. And some of the other countries, we are not particularly comfortable with the data that's coming out. And so we are staying away from those countries right now. I guess the other thing that I'll mention is, similar to what's happened in Australia, it's not just what happened with COVID. It was the policy response towards COVID. And so in countries where you had very draconian lockdowns, but that country didn't have the fiscal ability to do like JobKeeper or JobSeeker or keep people employed, the sort of double whammy of the epidemic and the lockdowns has been very detrimental to those economies. So that's why we have a preference for North Asia and sort of higher income countries within Asia.
And on a vaccine, we've seen markets rise and fall on the back of COVID-19 vaccine announcements. You mentioned earlier that your PhD was involved in a deep study of pandemics. What are the potential scenarios or scenario analyses that you have for a vaccine and their implementation both globally but also in the region that you're focused on?
So I answered this question with some hesitation because I'm sure your listeners know much more about this than I do. But this is what my team, me and my team have come up with. And if anyone has any comments, feel free to contact me on LinkedIn and tell me your comments. So yes, as you mentioned, my PhD thesis was about HIV/AIDS, and it was looking at an epidemiological model and then looking at certain points within the epidemiological model where you could do government economic policy to change the outcome or alter the outcome of an epidemic or of a pandemic. And I guess, you know, a vaccine, it would be very positive, obviously. But my concern is that every time there's been positive news on a vaccine, the market has gone up a lot. So, you know, Moderna says something positive and it goes up. AstraZeneca says something positive and it goes up. So I think that a lot of the positive news about a vaccine has already been baked in. But a lot of the sort of second order effects and second order considerations of a vaccine, nobody's talking about and nobody is even considering. So, you know, one of the issues that I looked at in my PhD was, okay, so what's the best way to spend limited fiscal resources? Do you spend it on prevention? Do you spend it on treatment? Do you spend it on treatment of TB, because obviously, as many of your listeners would know, HIV and TB co-infection is very high in Africa. So do you spend it treating TB but not HIV, or do you do nothing? These are sort of an array of possibilities. And part of the problem with antiretrovirals in low-income countries is that they're very expensive, and it's very, very difficult to actually distribute them. So, you know, decades after HIV has started and decades after antiretrovirals are available, there's still not the supply chain and the distribution to actually get them to the people that need them. So part of my concern for developing countries is that, you know, that it will be very difficult to actually execute people getting vaccines to a herd immunity level or to a level that will actually slow things down. Secondly, how much they cost and whether governments can afford it. So one of the things which is slightly disappointing in India is that most of the capacity that's being taken up to make potential vaccines is going to be shipped to developing countries. And there may not even, like I mentioned, the Serum Institute, there may not even be enough, despite the fact that India will be producing a lot of these vaccines, to actually vaccinate Indians. So I think that there is, I don't think that a vaccine is a panacea, certainly. And I think that a lot of the positive news of vaccines is baked into current market prices, where a lot of the negatives are being ignored.
Hmm. And COVID-19 has exposed many significant structural vulnerabilities worldwide. And in Australia, and I think in the US, the desirability of investing locally for production, such as reviving local manufacturing, has been talked about. Will countries look to invest more in their own home ground? And will that impact growth of Chinese and Asian markets, which do produce these products until coronavirus hit?
I don't think so. I think the globalization, it's hard to reverse globalization. And this is something which people in Asia have been talking about certainly for the last 4 years, because, you know, with the trade war between the US and China, it's, well, should supply chains just revert back to their own countries, because that's safer in the event that these two countries go head to head. You don't want to be caught in the middle with your supply chain, you know, half in one country and half in the other. And what we've seen is that it's very, very difficult to relocate supply chains, very difficult. And it's also even more difficult for developing countries to relocate supply chains onshore, because the cost differential is just so much. Some of the analysis that was done with respect to Apple taking its supply chain back to the U.S., if they had to do that and pay, you know, U.S. minimum wage and your iPhone would cost $7,000 or something like that. So it's just not really feasible to bring manufacturing onshore. I think people are just going to have to, figure out other ways of dealing with it. I think one thing, though, is that certainly the interconnectedness between different countries may reduce slightly. So, you know, my team typically spends a third of the year on the ground at least, and we probably won't travel to Asia for a period of 2 years, but we've learned how to do everything, on our laptop. So we've had over 500 Zoom calls and meetings with Asian companies so far this year. And I think that sort of, you know, learning to do virtual business is, that cat is out of the bag, and that's not going to go back in. But actually moving physical supply chains is going to remain a very difficult task.
And my last question is, we have an election coming up in the US on the background of these US-China trade tensions. What key risks and benefits do you see for the Asia region pre-election? And then how will the outcome of the election affect the region, do you think?
So pre-election, my expectation is that both Trump and Biden continue to be, you know, show anti-China sentiment because it's a vote winner. It's kind of the only thing that Democrats and Republicans can agree on is that neither of them like China. So I don't see that that's going to get any better between now and November. But afterwards, that is a very interesting question. And this is one of the things we have been discussing in terms of our scenario analysis. And a lot of our investors are asking us who's better for Asia, Trump or Biden. So it's not a clear cut answer. What we've heard on the ground in China is that there are people in the Communist Party who would prefer Trump to get a second term. And that may sound strange because, you know, there is the bashing China and starting trade wars and, you know, banning apps and whatnot. But at the same time, he has also in the last 4 years done immeasurable damage to America's standing in the world, whether it's pulling out of the Paris climate agreements or pulling out of the WHO or going against the WTO or building a wall with Mexico or starting a trade war with Canada. Like you name it, he's doing a lot of damage to the U.S. standing in the world. So if you're someone in China's leadership who's taking a long-term view of the world, if there's a president that's accelerating America's hegemonic decline, if he can stay in there for another 4 years, that would probably be better for China's long game. That said, as an investor, it would be nice to have Biden just because the policies would be less volatile. So, you know, Trump still tweets many, many times every night and we get up in the morning and he could have tweeted something that's, you know, bad for our companies. And it would be nice to have a more rational sort of adult foreign policy in a Biden administration. It would be a simpler environment in which to invest. I guess the other thing that we are contemplating is whether, assuming if Trump wins, whether it's a different Trump in term two. And there is some thinking that, you know, this whole China bashing has been to gain votes in America. And once Trump is in his second term, if he gets it, there's not really as much incentive to bash China. Trump has said many times that he actually gets along with Xi on a personal basis. And you could actually have an improvement in the relationship in the second term, which would be positive for Asia. So right now, we remain heavily invested in China. I think the downside for U.S. markets is much bigger than it is for Chinese markets. And but we invest in large cap companies so that we're nimble. And if things change, we can change our portfolio.
Fantastic. I feel like I could talk to you all day. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time today. How can listeners learn more about you and your funds?
Well, if you go to the Ellerston Capital website, it lists both Ellerston Asian Investments, which is an LIC, the Ellerston Asia Growth Fund, which is an unlisted trust, and the Ellerston India Fund. So you can find out more information there, or feel free to contact me on LinkedIn. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, I can definitely recommend that it's quarterly episodes that you've done on the funds has been excellent, with huge insights into most recently the ESG stuff has been very interesting as well, that people can find very good information in there. Fantastic. Thank you very much for your time today, mate. It was great having a chat.
Thanks so much, Andrew. I really appreciate it.
If you're interested in learning how to optimize your finances, please subscribe to this podcast. Also, head over to my blog, medicalmoney.com, and subscribe to stay updated. If you know a colleague who might also find this information useful, please share this with them. I'd love to get your feedback, so send questions, comments, and recommendations to me at andrew@medicalmoney.com. See you in the next episode.